Hi, this is Ed Long at Information Farm. Welcome, everyone, to another intelligence analysis with Ion and Bob Neverett. And today we'll be talking about the two cocks. David Wilcock interviews Graham Hancock.
So the first topic is the Ark of the Covenant.
The Lost Ark of the Covenant.
People who don't know, this is mentioned in the Bible. It's supposedly a sarcophagus or something?
Well, a wooden box. It's very clearly specified in the book of Exodus. It's a box which consists of gold and wood. So there's an outer box of gold, inside it a box of wood, inside that another box of gold. And, I'll just mention in passing that gold is a superb radiation shield. The whole aura that surrounds this box in the Old Testament is of a dangerous and deadly object. If you touch it, you die.
Yeah.
There are many accounts of people being struck dead by bolts of fire shooting out from the ark. Now, what the Bible tells us was in the ark was the two tablets of stone upon which the Ten Commandments were written by the finger of God himself. And so they were seen as the energy source of the ark, which were divine, supernatural, which sent out these bolts of fire and allowed the ark to lift up into the air. There are many accounts in and out of the Bible of the ark being used in battle, of the Israelites carrying it into battle, of it lifting its bearers off the ground, charging towards the enemies of Israel. There's an account where the Philistines briefly steal the Ark of the Covenant from the Israelites. They seem not to know how to handle it. They open its lid, and then within days they're all dying. Tens of thousands of them die. They file past it. They look at it like a tourist object, and tens of thousands of them die. And the Bible states that they died of cancerous tumors,
consistent with radiation poisoning.
It sounds like radiation poisoning. So,
okay, Ion, is that an accurate description of the Ark of the Covenant? A wooden box covered by a golden box, and inside?
No. First of all, back up. What it is they had in the brush arbor, in the original, before the first temple was built, they had to have a way to transport the sacred objects. And it started in Egypt, because they brought the bones of Joseph out in the Ark of the Covenant. And what it was an ash wood box that was just a box. And what they carried was the sacred artifacts that they brought to Egypt. This is the Hebrews. That they brought to Egypt, that they also then brought out of Egypt. Now, they also left with the spoils of Egypt, the gold and everything he could tote. But it was just a box. And Joseph, who set up this whole bondage business with the grain and the saving of the Hebrews of the day before they came under subjugation of Pharaoh, but it was the bones of Joseph and other precious artifacts that were carried in a wooden ash wood box. All right. Now, they got across the Red Sea. They got to Mount Sinai. Moses went up and got the Ten Commandments. Well, they sent him up after the law. He comes down. He sees they've taken the gold and fashioned a golden calf, Baal. They were worshiping because they didn't know how long Moses was going to be. Well, Moses said, choose. They chose, and then before they had to choose, then he smote the tablets on the ground, and they were broken. The broken tablets written by, quote, the finger of God. And then those were also deposited with the few that decided to hang around and choose. Those were deposited in the ashwood box.
You used the phrase, those that chose to hang around, what is that referring to?
Oh, Moses said after he broke the tablets that the children of Israel were to choose who's on the Lord's side. If you're on God's side, I am side, come stand over here. If you're not, then you stay right where you are. And then the lightning struck and all the gold melted. And they had to drink the gold of the golden calf that they had fashioned. Aaron is who built it, but he chose to go with Moses, obviously. But many of them did not. So they had to drink the gold, melted gold. And, of course, their flesh was consumed by fire because the melting point of gold was pretty hot.
Why did they have to drink it?
Because they chose, they didn't choose the superior power that Moses had been sent to Mount Sinai to get the law. They didn't even have to have a law until they sent Moses up after it.
That was a punishment? Those that didn't take Moses' side were punished by forcing them to drink the gold.
They were destroyed.
By drinking the gold?
Yeah.
Why would they choose to drink burning, scalding gold?
It was their god, Baal. So they took Baal into themselves. They had the power to do that.
This was not David Hudson's white powder gold ormai.
Oh, good Lord, no. This was just old-timey Egyptian gold.
They said, I'm not going with Moses. I believe in this gold, and I'm going to drink it and become ascended drinking this burning stuff.
They did. They got ascended.
Okay. Who initiated the parameters that they had to choose to be with Moses or drink the gold? Did Moses have that power over them?
No, the individual people chose, and when they chose Baal, and Baal was melted, the only opportunity they had then was to consume Baal, and then Baal consumed them.
Why would they think that there was some benefit to them to drink the hot gold?
Well, the way it flowed, they didn't have another choice. Their god was supposed to be more powerful than Moses' god, so therefore, and when it melted, they had to catch it. They had to catch the god. That was that graven image that they had been wrought. And that's the whole point. They set the rules and regulations. And when their god fell, then they had no choice but to drink the hot gold and lay their physical meat sack body down.
When Moses came down and, quote-unquote, caught them worshiping this idol that he was against, and they knew it, then they knew they were in trouble.
Why would they think they were in trouble? What power did Moses have since they didn't want to go with him, some of them?
They'd been following him all this time, so...
No, they didn't when they started worshiping the calf. They started following Aaron.
The reason that they got impatient and built a golden calf was because Moses had been up on Mount Sinai for 40 days or longer, not to mention the journey back and forth from climbing Mount Sinai, because it's a pretty treacherous hike, especially carrying the Ten Commandments, the stones. Well, they didn't know how long Moses was going to be, and they saw the fire on the top of the mountain. They didn't know about what Moses was consumed himself. So they talked it up amongst themselves and took the spoils of Egypt, the gold, and they had made Aaron form a golden calf, Baal, and layered it with the gold. They smelted the gold and layered it over the golden calf. Moses comes down the hill. His hair's white. He's obviously changed because of this experience that he's had with the burning bush and then the law. Then you got to remember, the children of Israel said, we want a king. We just got rid of Pharaoh, and now we want a king. So he sent Moses up to the mountain to get Yahweh, basically. That was before they knew what to call it. And then they used that in the Torah, that was the name you couldn't say or use. But Moses said, say, I am. So they said, okay, Moses, who's God? And he says, I am, the great I am. Now, he sees them in their idolatry and their worshiping in the calf, having a big hootenanny, a party. And Moses says, now, wait a second. It ain't been 5 minutes to Moses' time that you sent me to get a god, to get a king, to get the law, to tell y'all what's right from wrong. And I ain't been gone 5 minutes, and here you have done made a golden calf, which goes against everything for many, 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 many years they'd quote-unquote lived by. And they threw that out the window immediately. Now he's come back down, having an experience with the supernatural, and said, you're not worthy of God's law, the Ten Commandments. And he's mad, but Moses is furious. He said, choose you this day whom you will serve. And then the scripture reference that's made from that is, who's on the Lord's side? If you're with God, Yahweh, come stand over here. if you want to stay with Baal, stay right where you are. Well, they chose. A lot of folks chose. More than a third stayed with the golden calf. Then Moses broke the tablets. When he broke the tablets, fire rained down from the top of Mount Sinai, lightning, whatever you want to call it, and melted Baal, the god that more than a third of them were worshiping. And when it was devoured, the god, Baal, the gold, it was melted. When it was melted, the ones that chose to stay with Baal had no choice but then to drink Baal that had been melted. But for the sake of the story, so we don't get hung up right here, that's the end of the day. Everyone that chose Baal was either burned up by the gold, burned up by the fire from Mount Sinai in proximity of this flying gold, because it was an explosion, of course. Short version, they were consumed.
Well, once the Baal people made their choice, they had to abide by the consequences.
They didn't know what the consequences.
It didn't make any difference if they knew or not. They still chose.
They chose, and they didn't think much of Moses, so they thought it would be better to go to the Baal side. And I don't know, maybe they thought, maybe we don't know, or maybe you know, they knew there would be consequences if they chose Baal?
They thought that Baal would reign supreme over Moses' God.
So they thought that you're choosing sides and it's going to be a power struggle, and we're going to choose the Baal, and we're going to...
Yes. Because, Bob, the only reason we're having this conversation is because this is where the humans separated from their power.
We're talking about the box and where the gold came from.
That's correct. Now, it's an ash wood box, steel, right now. Now, all this gold has been melted, okay, because they drank it and there's gold all over the place. Well, it's melted. They take that gold, the Levites, only... the true part sons of Jesse, in the tribe of Jesse, the true part sons of God, from the root and the branch of David, they came, the Levites. The Levites were the ones who went first. They were in charge of the Ark of the Covenant. Well, they didn't call it, they just called it the Ark. But that covenant that was made from that choice at Mount Sinai, they took that very gold that was Baal, because there was a lot of it, and they took and they overlaid the ashwood box with that very gold. And there wasn't no inside lining and outside lining and all that kind of stuff. All they did was they gold-plated the ashwood box that was the ark.
What does the phrase brush arbor, you began the story with this phrase brush arbor, what does that refer to?
Before they had a temple, they had to house the Holy of Holies, that was the Ark. They had to house it in something. So they would take a cloth and boughs of trees, and they would build like a little tent thing when they were moving. Because, see, they were on a journey. You know, they were on a journey. Well, the brush arbor is what they used to house the Holy of Holies. Now, they took the box, the Ark, and they layered it with that gold. And that's the Ark of the Covenant that you know now. Okay?
And nothing more was done to it.
Well, here's what started happening. When those tablets went into the Ark of the Covenant with the bones of Joseph and with other very significant things that are contained within the Ark of the Covenant, some of that is the blood of the Passover lamb. Is also inside. The very religious, significant things that the Hebrews believed as super special, the symbols, because everything in that Jewish world was symbolic, you see, with this covenant between God in their power, in their place of power. Those were the articles that were contained in the ashwood box. Then the gold is overlaid, and it becomes a golden box. Now, if you start really looking at it, you're kind of going, now, wait a second. You mean that God destroyed Baal, this gold idol, and destroyed it because you can't have any images of God that you worship, And they took that very same gold and overlaid a box, the mercy seat, the Ark of the Covenant, that housed all their significant, important things, and took and made that box a god. Now, here's what's significant about that whole little rampant that we just did. The point is, that was the separation from man, human being, flesh, meat sack bodies, and their individual power. And that power was imbued, some say magically, but it was imbued into that box. That was the fall of man.
Like these people, you know, they have, I don't know, whatever you want to call them, the primitive instincts or the powerful manifestors, and they could put power into a box. And if they did that,
they did.
And they did not foresee the effects of that would be to diminish in the long run the power they'd already been kind of expressing as a people.
Exactly, and there's a whole lot of history that goes after that. But as the story unfolds, you can see how it falls away. The Levites were the only ones that were in charge of handling of the ark. They were the only ones that could touch it. They were the only ones that could handle it. They are the only ones that could move it. They were the only ones who could, anybody else that lay hands on the ark, they were consumed.
The Levites were the only ones who could dance around it and have sex around the ark.
Well, no, not have sex. Touch it. Handle it.
Oh.
Move it. Have any contact with it at all.
Could they dance around it?
Yeah, but they didn't. They were busy moving it.
Oh, you told me once before that they danced around it every day.
Well, they did. They protected it. They're the only ones that had access.
I meant musical dance, not like...
Sure,
walking cautiously.
They were the ones who went before. They always paved the way. When the ark was moving, they did pave the way, and that was done with music and dance, and there was a very liturgical order set up with when the ark was moving. Kind of like the parade. You know, if you got the parade, the minstrels would go first, and they'd bring the carriage holding the queen. Well, then they'd bring the Ark of the Covenant, you see. And then at night, when they got to where they were going to be, they had to build a brush arbor to protect it. It couldn't be open in the elements. That's why they had to build the temples to house the Holy of Holies, the Ark of the Covenant. Okay. Now, they've magically imbued this box with power, the ashen wood box with these elements that were significant to the symbology of Hebrew. Okay. With the tribes, because the tribes were busted up, 13 tribes, not 12, 13 tribes. The Levites, and those born of Levi, were the ones that were in charge of the Ark of the Covenant. First it was the Ark, then after they got through the desert and got across the River Jordan to Canaan, then it became the Ark of the Covenant. Then once it became the Ark of the Covenant, then once the original temple was built, then it was called the mercy seat. And that's when they had to establish a veil. That was when a veil that separated the Holy of Holies from the people. Because that
outside
of the body was not controllable.
Was this the first Solomon's Temple or was it pre-Solomon's Temple?
First Solomon's Temple, that's correct. Now you've got an ashen wood box that's covered with gold. Has sacred artifacts or special significant symbols inside the box, and that's all. But when they overlaid it with the gold from Egypt, from Baal, that's when it started to be magically imbued with the power of the human creators. And that's the first time that box took on that Ed was giving reference to earlier about it being magical or having this super charged conductivity business. Now, this power was so significant that the cloud of glory was moving. They followed the cloud by day. Now, they leave Mount Sinai and they go into the desert. 3-day journey took them 40 years. Everybody that was a naysayer that didn't believe died in that desert. Okay? But they followed a cloud of glory by day and a pillar of fire by night. And that cloud followed the ark, or the ark followed the cloud, or pick it up. You see, you can go with it either way you want to go. But anyway, they followed the cloud of glory by day and a pillar of fire by night. Now, the blessings that came out of this flow of power was every morning with the dew. It hadn't rained, you see. There wasn't rain much in the desert. But the dew, they had a heavy dew in the mornings. And this manna from heaven would fall. That's the orme that you were trying to make reference to earlier. That would come from the pillar of fire by night.
What was the modern chemical knowledge, molecular constituents of this orme, or manna?
N-A-A-U-O-3.
You would eat it? It would be some splotchy stuff that land on the sand?
Oh, it wouldn't be like that. It would be almost in the form of a mossy pita bread, you know, like flatbreads. It would be like that. It would be on the ground. When they'd wake up, the ground would just be full of it, and everybody could eat all they wanted. Fill your belly up. But they couldn't store it. You couldn't take extra. You could have all you could eat right then, but you couldn't take any with you or have it for later. It would wither away. It would just go to nothing.
And what does the word, are we allowed to use the word orme? What does O-R-M-E mean?
That's just a word humans thought that they wanted to call that.
Did they use that word orme back then?
No, they called it manna. Manna. Manna from heaven. That's where it came from.
And the human Israelis created that. They manifested that.
They allowed it into their experience. That's right. Because otherwise they'd have starved to death. Okay. So now, was that because of the ark? Or was that because of their relationship with the power? Or was that because of Yahweh or 126? That's all relative, you see. That there was power is what's significant about the story. Okay, everybody that bitched and grumbled and complained and did not have gratitude and appreciation for their journey, for their deliverance out of bondage, out of Egypt, every one of those that bitched and grumbled, they died. And they roamed around that desert for 40 years until everybody that had one nasty thing to say stayed in that desert. They rambled through that desert until everybody that grumbled died. Because they didn't understand gratitude and appreciation. It is significant. Gratitude and appreciation is very, very, very significant, yes. And then the final throes, when they was just about done with their journey, they was all thirsty. I'm tired of this manna. God sends us manna. Bitch. Till finally they says, we want some water. We're tired of this manna. This is manna, morning, noon, and night. Manna. I'm just sick of it. I'm tired. Moses, you drug us off here in this desert and got us all tangled up. At least we was making bricks out of straw in Pharaoh's Egypt, but we had the Nile River. We couldn't get a drink. Then all you got us is special manna from God. Yeah. Well, so finally Moses got crossways and he took his staff and he smote the rock. And when he smote the rock, water came from it. Well, God said, because of this separation deal, see, because now you got it in the ark, when he smote the rock, God says, uh-oh, you're accelerating. You said you wanted this power separate from you, and here you are exercising your power. So now, Moses, you've been disobedient.
Did he smote the rock out of anger or with the goal of manifesting water? Or?
He was sick and tired of them SOBs, ungrateful bastards, bitching because they wanted water. He'd had enough. He smote the rock, and this huge, vast flow of water flowed.
Did he intend that?
Yes, he did intend it, or it wouldn't have happened.
You're saying, though, that contradicted the purpose of the covenant, which was to put your own power outside in its bar.
Right.
But Moses dropped that whole belief system and said, well, I'll get over this issue by manifesting using my own power. And he smote
right.
The rock.
And when he smote the rock, because of he exerted his power, that rock became a river in the desert. And that's one of the four rivers that flows into the land of Eden, where Eden is, all the way over to Iraq. And that river is still flowing to this day.
That happened before Eden?
No. That flow, when he smote the rock, it brought the water up. The river was flowing under the sand.
By hitting the rock, it opened a fissure, so the river that was underneath came
open. That is correct.
They didn't know that was the Garden of Eden area, I assume?
Right, apparently, right. That's right.
Yeah, they didn't know, but it turned out that was the area, and the rivers, which were now underground, flowed above ground in the Garden of Eden, in that geographical area.
On the 32.5 parallel, Bob, that'll be significant in a minute. So now it's Crossways. Now, that gets you the Ark of the Covenant. That gets you up to this part. There wasn't no layers of layers of layers. Now, there was a thick plating of gold. We're not saying that. But they just hammered it, and it was not fancy and ornate. That comes at the second temple. But it was that gold, but it was they gave it more detailing as it went along. There was many more layerings of gold and decorations. Because, see, this was just taking gold, making it in sheets, hammering it onto the wood. Because the hot gold would have burned the wood. So it was basically like a gold plating kind of thing, or really, really thick gold leaf, like about a quarter of an inch thick.
That's the original.
Oh, yes. And see, they would burnish it then. They would smelt the gold, lay it in sheets, attach it to it, and then burnish it to get it to stick and nail it to the wood. So it was just a protection.
Later, people added other layers of gold to it.
They did, and decorations.
Gold decorations, like shapes or actual other materials?
Just gold, but they built it up and made it much more smooth and much more refined and basically made it finer, finished it.
They turned it into a fetish as it sat in the temples for hundreds of years.
That's right. That's thousands of years. Yes, that's correct. Good. And what they'd use it for, they realized, because they had separated their power from themselves, they realized that in battle, if they were to open the box or crack the box, they could never gaze on the glory of God. If you cracked the Ark of the Covenant and you looked at the box, then you'd be consumed because they'd made a deal. Just like the folk that chose Baal were consumed by fire. If you looked at the Holy of Holies, when it's been breached, the power that you gave it yourself, if you look into that, then you would be consumed as well.
That was a rule they had. That was a rule they had.
Now do you see why it was so important that you get the Baal story so you understand how it worked in the Ark of the Covenant story? Because by this time, see, you're coming into the Ark of the Covenant. Now, there's a covenant.
So I don't see the connection. The Moses faction was hypocrites and took the bad gold from the bad god and stuck it on their precious box. That's the only connection with the Baal scene.
No, Bob. They chose. The people that chose Baal and they looked at Baal, they were consumed. The people that chose Yahweh in the form of the power being held in the Ark of the Covenant, if they gazed on that God or that power, they would be consumed because that was
the phenomenon that happened with Baal. They not only laid the gold from the bad Baal into their precious box, they brought over the consuming phenomenon.
That's exactly right, because they had imbued it. See, this didn't come from God somewhere way off up yonder. This came from the individual human creators. That's where the power came from. So if you give your power to something, then it has your power. Then you've got to do what it says you can do. Well, that's all right because you're still human. You get to create. But guess what, Bob? If you make all these rules and regulations regarding it, then you, remember, not usurping of the labyrinth of your mind, your rules and regulations, you will not allow yourself to usurp your rules. It won't allow you. So therefore, you fall dead just like everybody else. Well, they learned. They was tricky with this business. If some big army was coming, them giants and all these problems that they were having once they got across the River Jordan, they knew that if they got crossed up, all they had to do was crack the box, crack the magic box, and look away, and whoever was coming after them would be consumed. Some of the text, they've translated it so many ways you can't tell which end is up, of course, but in the original, translations, it said that the people who gazed on the power of God, okay, they evaporated. Basically, went into molecular dust. So the army, all that'd be left would be their armor and their swords and their helmets and their shoes, their flip-flops and their tube tops and whatever they had on. As far as you could see, it'd just be their clothes. Well, then the Hebrews that had been de-Egyptianized, because see, they were in the Egyptian reign, they'd spend all day every day gathering up the stuff from this army after army after army that was just, now it was just stuff. So they was having to gather up all their accoutrements to haul around with them. So they became a great moving storage facility from army after army that they'd get crossed up with. All right. Boy, that's a whole lot of tic-tacs just to get you up to this place of what the Ark was and how the Ark got its power. Now, is that clear?
I find it interesting that the battle between the Baalites and the Moses gang, both aspects of that dramatic melting of the gold, is in the Ark of the Covenant.
Absolutely. That's why we spent that hour to make sure we got that as clear as we possibly could, so you could go, aha, right now. So very good.
Just looking at the poetry of it, that this power of the Ark to consume people was the contribution of the Baalites to the Hebrew mythology.
Well,
did the Moses back and think of it that way? When they saw that the armies would die and get consumed by looking at it, they said, lucky we got some of that Baal stuff in here.
No, did not.
So what I'm thinking now is the first time that it's been thought about that.
But see, this isn't the first time that they've energized their power.
No, you're saying it's the first time it was displaced from the people into this object or box. That was new. But many civilizations before that imbued power more close to themselves, or?
They imbued it into things. They most certainly did. Because there was tons of power. That was the big battle. That was the battle between Pharaoh and Moses. Because Pharaoh was sitting there, Moses would say, let my people go. My God is more powerful than your gods. And then Pharaoh's like, I'm a god myself. You better watch out, Moses. Well, everything that Pharaoh would conjure, and he could, he had power. He didn't put his power in no box. He had his power. But everything he'd conjure up as power, Moses would come back against it. See?
He'd whoop his ass every time.
And then Moses would say, let my people go. I've done been here 9 times. And these plagues have come on Egypt because you've made it hard on us, these Hebrews. You've made it hard on us. So at every time, my God has come in here and tore you up with the plagues. And then the last one will be, finally, they knew Pharaoh had listened. He'd been reading the printing press. And there was a prophecy that the deliverer was coming, that there was going to be a great exodus, and it would be the firstborn. So Pharaoh said, well, hell, I know how to take care of this. We'll just whoop and destroy every firstborn Hebrew. Okay? Well, if you go backwards, that's how Moses got to Egypt the first time. It's because he was a firstborn. The story goes on and on and on and on.
Yeah, when you're saying first time, is this like the movie The Matrix where Neo's coming through the whole drama the sixth time? Are you saying that this whole drama happened in 9 different spanses?
Oh, yeah. The plagues came one after the other in Egypt. The plagues that caused the exodus. Every time Pharaoh would do something to the Hebrews, Moses would go say, let my people go.
There were 9 attacks on the Hebrews.
Yeah. Well, the 10th one was the Passover, and that's when they were going to kill all the firstborn again to make sure that this deliverer wasn't going to show up, because now the price of poker had gone way up at this point. They'd done turned the Nile River into blood. It was a pretty big deal, you see, and the frogs and the lice and the blah, blah, blah of all the different plagues.
All that you're telling us, does the Pope know this stuff?
He certainly should.
Did anybody in the history of the Catholic Church know this story as you're laying it out?
They should.
Why? Because it's in the Bible? It says this?
Well, they have all the references and the empirical references in the Vatican Bibliothèque. to be able to verify it.
Do they have the Ark of the Covenant in the Vatican?
Oh, good gracious, no.
Okay, back to what you were saying, the tenth time.
Anyway, the last one, when they were exercising their power, not in the box. Okay, they had the box. They had the box in Egypt, but they had their power within themselves. Okay? So the last one was the Passover. And the Passover was that they had these certain rules and had to put the blood of the firstborn lamb, the sacrifice, the perfect lamb, and you smear the blood of the lamb over your doorpost. And if you did that, that's a rule, if you did that, then the Passover lamb would pass over you. But if not, then this angel, the death angel, would come and take only the firstborn. And that's when Pharaoh's son was taken. And that's what set off the Exodus.
The Pharaoh got weakened at that phenomenon. He started to lose
his
exactly power.
Right. And he had a nagging wife saying, Moses' God is bigger than your God. And then Pharaoh says, uh-uh. He says, my God, Dagon, will save my son. It'll be more powerful than Moses. Well, the little child rotted, laying on this statue of this Dagon that was supposed to save him. And they even got Horus and Anubis and all of them stirred up pretty good in this God world, and none of them would bring Pharaoh's son back. So Pharaoh's wife turned around and says, boy, you sure are some big God, ain't you? Killed your son, showed you up. You know, I don't even believe your goober's big as you thought it was, Mr. God. So that's when they went tearing out after Egypt, when they left Egypt chasing all of the released exodees, is that what you call the exodus? The exodees went to chasing them, which is what had to get the Red Sea parted in the first place. But now that's what happened just before your gold story with your ark. That's when it was called the ark. But the only reason we went through all that was because before Mount Sinai, the individual human creators had their power. After that, that was the separation.
That's the fall of man.
Correct.
But that doesn't happen to Tibetans or Chinese. They don't have the same effect, right?
Now, Chinese a bit, because their lore is a little bit different. But Tibetans, no. Elders, no. The elders, no. They never separated. They never separated from their place of power.
Where are the elders?
In the mountains.
Of what part of the world?
Oh, there's lots of them.
Are they in Asia?
Yes.
They've lived for thousands of years without transitioning?
Many. They've never buried an elder.
Then Melchizedek, who now lives in Afghanistan, is he hanging out with the elders?
No, he is not. Now, don't run over that, Bob. You've hit a good point there. Normally, you'd be all over that like a bad habit. But you let that one slip. Let's back up a little bit. Did you hear what we said? They have never buried an elder in China. If they're an elder, they've not buried them.
No.
Not one elder buried anywhere.
They're walking around still functioning.
Well, hell yeah.
How tall are they?
Average is about 5'5". They do vary a bit. But what you'll find, though, is they start taking on about the same height and the stature. They start taking on about the same girth as far as size. They don't do weights. See, the weight really doesn't, they don't give any flavor to weight. But as far as their shoulders and their midsections and their muscles and how they look, their physical appearance, they start kind of resembling each other. For example, like some of them in the Tibetan world, they don't have to get new clothes because the next one, and the others, as they have these special clothes, they're all the same size because all of those elders are about the same size.
Did Mao Zedong meet any of these elders?
Never met.
Did anybody that we know in, quote, history, you know, that's famous, did anybody from any culture meet some elders?
Oh, yeah, Marco did.
Marco Polo, okay.
Yo.
Did you say Mao Zedong didn't even know they were
Right. That's correct. Because, see, they get that tangled up. They think the government is China, and that's not. Now, some of the dynasties, they did. Some of the dynasties did. Ming knew the elders, and Ming got much power from the elders.
We were talking about the fall of man, and it didn't affect certain pockets of humanity. But it did go beyond Europe into Asia?
It did.
So it resounded through Earth. It resounded, this Ark of the Covenant separation.
Everything does, Bob.
Everything does, right. And that's
everything
what I think caused...
Everything resounds through Earth.
That's what we call the Rai principle, which was the original
it
separateness.
Did.
And
that's why they use that word, and we don't have a problem with it. Call it what you want to. But the point is that Rai separation is critical because that's where you start having all these questions. Those were your degrees of separation came along. Before that, there was no who, what, when, where, and how, and why. You didn't have to ask those questions. You knew. Well, if you knew, you didn't have to ask.
The use of symbols by the Hebrews, that's the beginning of emphasizing the I and writing. That's the communicative matrix that creates this separation.
It is. Now, that came, from Samaria. You know the story with that. We don't want to beat it quite to death, but many of those symbols that they were using, they were trying to make themselves separate, but they weren't. They'd use the old symbols, applying it into the new religion. That's kind of like why Jesus' birthday all of a sudden became December the 25th, because that's when all the big party was going on anyway. Just real convenient to make it then, you see. So there's not a tried and true set point of how all that gobbledygook ran together. They borrowed from themselves. There's no question with that. And that's not a problem.
They borrowed what from themselves?
They borrowed all these symbol dates that you...
From their history. Okay, you don't need to win that. The point you're making is symbols were used for parallel worlding.
Yes.
They were a tool. But when you get into an abstract thought and turn it into a concept, which the Hebrews tended to do, they turned the symbols into concepts, and that was the beginning of the separation, or schizophrenia, not knowing the function.
Yes. Your thread is very good. It's not near complete, but it's very true, very right, and very much on point. Now, there's voluminous things you can go with just from there, but where you're reaching for is exactly point on point. But that's not the direction you were trying to get to, but we will validate, yes, that's exactly the case. But now there's encyclopedias that could go just from that topic, obviously. Okay, now, did that catch us up? Are you ready to go with a little bit more?
The Ark is someplace in the world today, in our world, and how did it get there? It's not with the Jews anymore, is it?
No, it hasn't been with the Jews since the destruction of the Second Temple.
Is it before the historical record?
Yes, before.
So the Bible is the first historical record then?
No, it's not the first, but they all give the countings of about the same times, but the times that they're counting, that's why there is no time. That's why it gets all crossed up, because they got Jesus living 33 years, but give 1,500 years worth of history in 33 years. So, see, that's the problem. You got this one's telling that one's telling this one's telling that one, and then they're each giving. You got Babylon. You got the Babylonians in that whole realm, too.
The Babylonians is the time of the Second Temple?
Yes.
What was happening in Hawaii at that time?
Hawaii was underwater.
Was there Lemuria at that time?
No, it was not.
There were not Easter Island.
Easter Island was more out of the water. It was larger than it is today.
And was there a species on it?
Yeah.
The Lemurians were there happening on Easter Island at the time of the Second Temple.
No. That was a little bit before.
Lemuria was a little bit before. Or the temple was, which was a little bit before?
The Lemurians were a little bit before.
Yeah, because they got scurried off the Easter Island by the Romans?
Not the Romans. It wasn't the Romans. It was the Carpathians.
Okay, all right. Okay, so back to...
close by, but you see all that? One was conquering this one and that one, and on and off is running like a sieve all the time.
At the time of the Second Temple, that's when the Chinese got the Ark of the Covenant.
Oh.
Maybe they got it later. So who took it from the Jews?
That was pillaged from the debt they didn't get paid. That was from Cleopatra.
She was the first to take it out of the hands of the Jews.
Well, supposedly to protect it. But it was because the debt didn't get paid because they borrowed money to build the temple.
The debt wasn't paid.
The Knights Templar started the banking system, didn't you?
But Cleopatra started it?
She did.
So Cleopatra starts the banking system. The Knights Templars don't exist at that point. They haven't arrived yet.
Lord, no. They're way, way, way. See, you can't come into the Knights Templars as being this famous Catholic sect when you, about 4,000, 5,000 years before Peter, what their church was built on, is born.
So our dating of Cleopatra is somewhere around
sucks.
The time of Jesus.
Yeah,
sucks. Yeah, it's not real. But
sucks. There's no time. That's right.
So Cleopatra says, okay, guys, I gave you money for building the temple. You can't pay me back, so I'm taking the ark. And they accepted that. Jews accepted
and
that.
And they burned it. No, they burned it first. Well, they set it afire. Now, what would that matter? You got a stone temple. How can you burn a stone building? But they did. So apparently there was some power involved, and they got that. And it would have to be the Levites that got it out.
Cleopatra got it. And
handle it.
Did Cleopatra hire some Levites to make it safe in her presence? Right.
The fall of man related to the power in the Ark of the Covenant, how does that compare to the fall in Genesis in the Garden?
Well, that hadn't happened yet, Ed. You got it all backwards. Hebrews read from the back to the front. You got to take Revelation with the thinning of the veil and go back to the Garden. See, even your Christian faith is trying to get back to heaven on earth as it is in heaven. The Garden is coming. It's not here yet, you see. That's why they call Jesus, when he returns, the second Adam. Well, if you read it like the Hebrews would have written it, that'd be the first Adam going back to the original Adam, which will be the last Adam.
The fall of man does not happen in the Garden of Eden. It happens at the time of the Ark.
Well, yeah, because that's when you arrive. That's not when
you fall. So the Garden of Eden, when you arrive, that's when the fall is diminished or grows strangely dim.
That's called utopia. Utopia. Mm-hmm.
Does Ethiopia possess the Ark of the Covenant? Okay.
The flow of my own life led me into the inquiry into ancient mysteries. Hmm. As a correspondent based in Nairobi in Kenya during the early 80s, I frequently visited Ethiopia. It was on my beat. It was a place I went to very, very, very regularly. And during visits as a reporter to Ethiopia, I came across the seemingly extraordinary claim that the Ethiopians make to have possession of the lost Ark of the Covenant. The Ark itself, as in Indiana Jones' Raiders of the Lost Ark. All these things intrigued me, and especially so when I went to Ethiopia and went to the sacred city of Aksum in northern Ethiopia during a time when Ethiopia was locked in a deadly civil war. And this town was in a very hotly contested zone. It was extremely difficult to get into. And I found myself in the presence of a monk who claimed to be the guardian of the Ark of the Covenant.
Let's just stop there. The monk that Graham met, was he the guardian of the Ark of the Covenant?
No.
He sat out in the grounds of a little chapel annexed to an ancient Christian cathedral called the Cathedral of St. Mary of Zion.
Now, we're just not going to let that go. You know, lot of it is due to subjugation, and that's fine. But now you've hit something. You don't mix the Zionist with the power of the Ark of the Covenant. The Zionist is a completely separate organization. The Zionists are the whole Carpathian rule. We mentioned that earlier on purpose. You can't mix the spirits when you get to this particular part.
You're objecting to the cathedral being called Zion?
Absolutely. And how is it a Christian cathedral when it was from Zion?
So tell us what Zion in actuality refers to, that word. What is Zion?
The Carpathians.
The Carpathians were Zionists? They were Zion.
Zionists, yes. That's correct.
What does the word Zion mean to the Carpathians?
God.
Zion was their word for their religion?
Zion is what they call their Holy of Holies.
And what was their Holy of Holies?
They said it was contained, magically imbued in a box. Now, let's get this clear. Now, I want to answer your question that you asked when you were smart asking your question. Did the Ark of the Covenant go from Cleopatra to Ethiopia? Okay.
I said to China, I think.
No, but
anyways,
wanted to know the North Africa reference for this point. It went
yes.
on a journey. It did go through there, but not to that chapel and not to that place and not to there at all. Not at all. But it did flow because it wasn't far going south. It ended up to go through there. It's been in many places, but did go through there for a moment. But about we're talking about a week whole journey, more than we're talking about 1,000 years and still sitting there. Because here you go. The Carpathians, don't you remember in the time of the Tower of Babel? Well, they had an ark as well.
The Carpathians did, or the Tower of Babel culture did?
They're the same. Carpathia is Tower of Babel.
And they had an ark, not Moses' ark. They had another ark?
That's correct. And it was smaller, and it had sacred artifacts, and they layered it in gold, and they counted it as all of this magically imbued power. See, the story rolls and rolls and rolls.
The inspired idea you get from that is the effect of writing would show up in different cultures, and it would evoke this archetype of the box. That's the effect of writing.
That's exactly right, and it was smaller. Now, the dimensions of the mercy seat, the Ark of the Covenant, are very, 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 very specific. And if you finally got one of these monks that's going to be talking to one of these cocks, that's going to be speaking to one of these cocks, going to tell them all the news that is news about the Ark of the Covenant, man, please, you know, easy. Don't offend yourself with having that conversation.
You said cop. You mean C-O-P-T, the Coptic Church.
No, we're talking about cocks. You have
the cock, the David in the grave. If you had the Ark of the Covenant, you're not telling anybody.
And if
you're not bragging,
the only one on the planet looking after it, you're not going to grant an interview. Good. But anyhow, the box that the Zionist rule is smaller. It would be about 3 foot by 2 foot, which is much, much, much smaller.
It's interesting to me that you have several cultures having the box archetype evoked to become the new source of charisma outside of oneself, and that is what McLuhan says writing did to people. You bring up some esoteric history that proves...
long before Marshall.
Yeah, of course. Well, I don't know why you say that. He's one of the first to describe the effect of writing to create this split separateness or schizophrenia, or taking symbols as conceptual rather than as the efficient tools for parallel worlding. All that effect, you bring up this esoteric point that other cultures had an ark, at least one other, so that the ark effect is not limited to Israel, it is limited to those cultures that are starting to get into a certain kind of in-depth writing.
Yeah.
And you agreed with that before the disconnect.
Well, writing, or let's say recording, or keeping a story. Because it's got to have other dynamics other than just printing press.
This is before the printing press. Just writing systems. We're moving towards the eye and the eye dominance and civilized values around the eye. And the eye, in McLuhan's canon, is a neutral separating medium or sense.
Well, it's not an eye.
It's not as involving as the ear cultures, which are before writing.
Okay, that's why the Egyptians had an all-seeing eye and not an all-hearing ear.
That's why McLuhan said the huge pyramids, these huge sculptures, was the transition from the audio tactile cultures to the beginning of the eye cultures. And they weren't totally into the eye culture, but in the transition, they started to try to contain the hugeness of acoustic and tactile space, and you came up with pyramids.
No, they came up with boxes to imbue their power.
The Hebrew culture.
Carpathians older than the Hebrew.
Yeah, that's my point. All right, so the box... The pyramids come at an earlier phase, or maybe you would say not. Maybe the pyramids come in full-fledged eye cultures?
Yes.
Egypt had writing.
They had the hieroglyphs, Bob. That was the whole point. They etched it into stone so it would hang around so you could see in your future what they knew in their past, which is only now, because you're still finding it every day in your now. And there's lots that was done then that you don't know was done then, because your future hadn't got up to your now yet.
So the I is a new archetypal image in the Egyptian culture. They didn't make the ear a big deal because they came out of an ear dynamic in the pre-writing phase of their life.
That's why Jesus said time and time and time, let them that have eyes to see, see, and let them have ears to hear, hear. See, Jesus was quoting Marshall McLuhan there, you see. Jesus was going into the archetypal means that had been established, and he knew what Marshall meant, so he was cleaning it up so Marshall wouldn't have near a harder time now that he's having now that he had then that he couldn't do now.
The future planted Jesus' remarks in the past so that McLuhan would have something validated when he showed up now.
No, Jesus was quoting McLuhan because it's about McLuhan.
And what McLuhan used to take this quote, he used to point out this one, it is written, but I say unto you. That's the emphasizing the ear. It is written, but I say unto you.
Uh-huh.
And you've talked about the major minor prophets
yeah.
in their towns and
yeah.
villages. They would just all of a sudden get inspired and start spouting off right
exactly.
there in the market.
And much of Ezekiel was quoting Marshall McLuhan, of course. Yeah.
And McLuhan was quoting Finnegan's Wake, so you see why Finnegan's Wake is the nexus, the Bible that contains all cultures.
Mm.
All media. That's why Finney's Wake is the more important artifact.
Good. Yes, it is. It is. Good. Very good. Okay, now back to Zion.
Okay.
And he said, yes, the Ark of the Covenant is in there.
The conventional view is that it either is a myth or that it has gotten lost or something,
well,
right?
Nobody
knows where it is.
Let me just come to that first.
Okay.
Really tweak my attention, because remember those accounts in the Bible of how the ark strikes people dead and,
right.
and causes cancerous tumors. Well, these guys, the guardian of the ark, once he's appointed as guardian, he must stay as guardian for the rest of his life. And he can never leave the grounds of that little chapel.
You want to comment on
who was piping in the music, the elevator music over it?
It's a radio show, so he probably thinks he has to have a bit of musical background. Right, Ed?
Yes, that's correct. David has a friend who's won several Grammys, and he paid him to compose some music, and then they played it in the background on this audio.
Yeah, because the verbal content isn't that significant for the tactile experience that people want to have. They want to have all the senses, so you got to have a bit of music to drown out the verbs, the wordy words.
Whoa. So Ray Land must have been right. It was a conspiracy to run over your mind. That's what it was.
It's a conspiracy. It's a preference. It's a sensory preference since TV to have all the senses engaged, not just listening raptly to a speaker speaking in a silent background. And that's literacy speaking, and you tend to follow with your eye. So this cancels out the eye effect by having some musical subliminal seduction.
Well, okay.
You know, Graham is making a big deal out of this con man priest who stays in one place and has an alibi that he's getting cancer from the covenant. I mean, pitiful. I mean, these guys are living in the past.
Why would you sign up to be the guardian of the thing that was going to kill you and it killed 4, 5, or 3 in the years? And they have such short lives anyway. What's the benefit? You know? I mean, at least with Allah, you get them 70 virgins. I don't know what you're supposed to do with them, but at least you get them virgins out of the deal. It doesn't sort of serve a human creator very much if they're protecting the source of all power on the planet if it runs you out of your physicalness.
Did you write a book on the Ark of the Covenant, Ed?
Yes, he did.
Oh, okay, so he's making a big case, or one of many cases. He has different anecdotes of this one guy with cancer. I mean, this is hilarious. Did that evoke anything you want to clear up, Ion?
Oh, just how nice the elevator music was.
So the Carpathians had their ark, and did they also have the Hebrew ark?
No.
But you're saying the Carpathians did get the Jewish ark?
No, Bob.
So we're back to our question, who gets it after Cleopatra?
Well, it moves through Africa on a very short, quick, fast journey, and it goes to a port, and then it gets on a boat, a very, very fancy boat, like a barge.
And who's carrying it through Africa?
The only ones that could ever touch the Ark of the Covenant was the Levites.
Oh, they know that the temple's been destroyed. They're on the run, so to speak.
They took it out before it was being destroyed.
They decided to go a long distance, get well away of their native land to hide it somewhere or deposit
it
somewhere.
Far. It wasn't that far. It was.
What, to walk all the way through Africa?
Well, Bob, it's not that far.
What do you mean it's not that far? It's thousands of miles.
Oh, it's not like this. No, it's not. Well, fine.
It's a long walk from Cleopatra to... Did they only go the northeastern part of Africa?
Nope. They went further all the way past through Mesopotamia, back through Egypt, back across the Mediterranean, back through Africa, down to, I guess it would be what you call now Zimbabwe.
So the way you said it, it begins in, the second temple is in Babylon, which is in Mesopotamia, and then is carried across the northern part of Africa and sails on the Mediterranean a little bit.
Well, the second temple, Bob, is in Israel.
Why do you mention Mesopotamia?
They had to walk through Mesopotamia before they got there.
In other words, Israel was ransacked and the Jews were taken into captivity in Babylon. Israel, according to today's map, is right there on the ocean, or the Mediterranean Sea. You got to go back to the east to get up to Mesopotamia. Why were the Levites over there in Mesopotamia?
Because Cleopatra owned it now because of the debt that it had to be repaid.
Oh, we thought we were talking about after Cleopatra, but you're talking about the journey that Cleopatra took it on.
Exactly, yes.
So she gets it in Israel, takes it over east to the Mesopotamia, then comes back down and along the Mediterranean across the north of Africa, and then passing through Ethiopia, and then down to Zimbabwe. Okay, got it. So that's the Cleopatra possession.
Correct.
So what happens in Zimbabwe?
Then it gets loaded on another barge, maybe a more of a seaworthy vessel, and it takes another little journey. Now let's go back to your recording. We don't want to get too far ahead.